Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Comics Collective, the weekly podcast where we talk about our favorite comics and graphic novels. I'm your host, Dallas.
And I am Alan Moore. I got it. I can't do it. Can't stop this.
Can't stop. Won't stop. This is the concluding episode of our Alan Moore coverage. The entire month of March, except the first week, we have covered Alan Moore. And we lost Alexis a third of the way through.
Yep.
Could we have predicted it? Yes. Did we predict it? No.
Were we surprised?
Also, no. We lost her. She was playing the long game. She told us like 6 weeks ago she was going to have to start being a little lighter on the podcast as she approaches her wedding. And she decided to cash all those chips in Alan Moore month.
Hey, she's taking her PTO. Good on her, queen. Go for it.
Good on her. And so if you don't follow our social media channels, you may be expecting a Halo Jones episode. That was Alexis's pick for Alan Moore month. And since she's not able to be with us this week, we pulled...
An impulse switch.
And Anne... Could you let the people know what we're covering this week if they can't read on Spotify?
For all of you out there that can't read and need us to tell you how to feel about comics, we're reading Top 10 this week because I went into a comic shop earlier in the week and I knew they had the Top 10 compendium and Tom Strong had me in a mood. So I picked up the whole ass compendium and I'm like, hell yeah, this is great. And then when we figured out Lexi wasn't on the show, that'd be the perfect book to talk about. We are talking about the first 12 issues of Top 10, because there are several different Top 10 series and sequel series. We're reading the original 12 issues, so sorry for anyone who wants to hear us talk more about Jeff Smacks. We did not read that many as of yet, but I want to. The original 12 issues by Alan Moore, Gene Ha, and Xander Cannon.
And the always incredibly talented Todd Klein on letters.
Absolutely.
Todd Klein did all the lettering work for all of America's Best Comics, and this has been a tour de force of lettering. If you thought Multiplicity Man or whatever his name was, Many Little Robot Bug Guy, if you thought his lettering was cool with all of the echoing voices behind the text, then boy, do I have something to tell you about an invisible woman who's bubbles are as translucent as she is. It's fantastic. You can hear the voices of these characters with Todd Klein's lettering. And he's doing it all by hand. Todd Klein is the greatest letterer of all time. He is to lettering what Dave Stewart is to coloring.
How he do that?
No, I'm
seriously asking. How the fuck did he do that?
I don't know.
How do you not do that, ditch? What? I'm looking back through it. I'm mad now because I need to know.
Did you know he lettered the first three issues of Tom King's Batman and then he quit because Tom King makes too many changes on the line level dialogue and things?
I didn't know that.
He's like, I'm all done. Oh, yeah. We were probably on that interview together.
Yeah.
But let me just tell you again. Let me mansplain an experience you had with me.
Do you remember that? No, please go ahead. Tell me all about it.
Listen, that's called a rhetorical device where I'm informing the viewer.
Oh.
And like I'm talking to you.
Okay. Got it.
A big part of our friendship is just we talk at each other, but we don't listen.
Yeah. What?
Exactly. Something about a Star Wars or a Dunkleosteus?
I can still spell it.
Even though it's a little goldfish now.
Fucking scientists. Woke science won't leave the goddamn Dunkleosteus alone. Coming for a most... I don't know.
Beloved toothless monster. Anyway. For those of us that aren't deeply invested in the Devonian Sea, I need us to talk.
Everyone but me. They don't call it the Devonian for no reason, you know? I'm just saying. Age of fishes, that's where it's all at. So keep going. Talk, speak, say anything.
The slippery guys. Top 10, if you are unaware, is Alan Moore's approach to a police procedural set in a city completely populated by superhero and science hero characters. All the way down to the mice in our walls. Everyone has a gimmick. Everyone has a power. Everybody has a shtick. And our police procedural explores all the most interesting corners of that kind of world.
It's, you know, for anyone out there, I'm gonna cite it. It's funny because I was talking about it a bit in the bonus episode too. But for anyone out there that's seen My Hero Academia, that's basically a pretty similar premise where it's a world where there's so many people with superpowers that you need some way to deal with it. My Hero Academia is like, well, what if superheroes were the main way you take care of it? Whereas Top 10 is like, what if the superheroes became cops and that was the main way you took care of it? And that basically tells you everything you need to about the difference in approach and tone of the two stories. Top 10 is a story that is very visceral at times, but also never not tongue-in-cheek. It's a really, really interesting experiment of like sweet and sour at the same time, where there's moments that have you like completely and utterly shaken and you're like, holy shit, that's insanely deep, or that's insanely emotional, or that's insanely racist. Holy shit. I can't believe we just said that. I can't believe we've invented new slurs for robots. That's really fun. But then there's other moments where you're like looking at the background gags, and there's a moment in the hospital and you're looking around, and you see a Dr. Fate walking around in his little helmet and his tie. This comic is for me, it's another one that I felt like Alan Moore wrote with a smile on his face, because it's poking fun at comics, but never forgetting the fact that comics were fun to begin with. You wouldn't, like, why poke fun at something you hate? There's a lot of self-awareness and love that goes into this book that, you know, sometimes comes off as a bit mean-spirited, sometimes, most of the time, comes off as really... I had the word on the tip of my tongue, but like loving and reverent, I think. So it's just another book that reminds us that at one point Alan Moore genuinely liked making comics and was having fun with it.
I think this is much more Brooklyn Nine-Nine than it is Seven. Mm-hmm. And that is really fun.
It's like if Brooklyn Nine-Nine had the dialogue of Seven.
Yeah. Yeah. That's actually exactly right. I think Alan Moore can't help but be Alan Moore, right? But this is Alan Moore's love letter to exactly what you said, the wackiness of the superhero universe. I think for me, this book became transcendent when the fight between the superpowered cats and the superpowered mice came to the level of a crisis event. And there was like a Beyonder. There was the universe of Marvel. There was a Galactus mouse. And then a few issues later, the exterminator couldn't be paid because the mice and the cats had rewrote continuity to erase the events of everything happening. And it just felt so funny. Or when, like, the heart-wrenching moment of, and spoilers for Top 10, when Detective Lee dies and they're like, and may she rest in peace until she is cloned, copied, created into an artificial intelligence, or in some other way brought back by a plot contrivance. And I was like, I think I love this book.
Yeah.
Like the sort of self-aware comedy of the kind of world that would operate with the rules of a comic book, where these characters mm-hmm. know they're getting rebooted, they're getting brought back to life, they're XYZ, all the things that we love to hate about comic books are essential bits of world building in Top 10.
Mm-hmm. And it's talking about a comic that is always, always world building. There is not a single panel in this book that feels wasted. Like, you'll be reading it and you'll be reading along the story and there'll be panels that just exist. Like, there's just a panel where there's no words. It's just people flying or people walking. And if you take a second to look in the panel, you'll see so many of those background gags. The billboards are really fun. I remember seeing one for a movie called Businessman, and the tagline was, "You'll believe a man can't fly." And there's not a single wasted bit of space in this that isn't constantly working on the bit, trying to improve the world, give you a laugh, and just really explore how crazy this place can be. I love, from an artistic side, the designs of not just the characters, but the city itself. It is the first fictional city I've ever seen in a comic book universe that actually feels like it shows the ramifications of what that would be. You have buildings that stretch into the sky, and there's apartments specifically for people that can fly. I remember there's a woman who can fly bringing food back for her babies, which are in a nest on the top of a skyscraper, and right next to them there's a cantina, like a bar, for people that are just that are as tall as skyscrapers. And you have floating, like, towers of mystery up in the sky. Just the way this book opens, where you see one of our main characters, Toy Box, riding the train to her first day at Top 10, and she's on a train, and it's completely normal people. And then it transitions to all the people leaving, and then all these superheroes getting onto the train, instantly immersing you from something very realistic, very normal, into this absolutely insane batshit world. And I think it's one of the best comic book openings I've ever read in anything, ever, period. It sets everything up that you need to know about this comic and its tone from the get-go. It's a book that, fortunately, feels so long when you're reading it. These issues are so dense and so rich, but you never want the fucking thing to end, because you're just having too much fun with it. It's like, it's another one of those things where it's like, I feel like the bit could get old really quickly, but it doesn't, because Alan Moore and Gene Ha are so smart at how they approach this, that they keep finding new ways to reinvent the bit and go further with the bit. And it never gets stale.
I also think there are comics where the density becomes a punishment. Mm-hmm. And that is not the case with the Top 10 and Tom Strong comics that we read over the last 2 weeks. Both of those felt very dense, but in a way that I was enjoying, and I felt like I was, quote, getting my money's worth, right? These 300 pages, they felt like I was reading a 300-page novel, not like I was zipping through a 300-page magazine. And that was really special. It was special when I can look down the barrel of 12 issues of Top 10, and while that could be a nothing burger with other writers at the helm, it was a week's worth of dense, interesting reading from Alan Moore. Mm-hmm. And I think everything you said about world building is incredibly pertinent to what Alan Moore loves. If you, and here it is again, Dallas referencing Alan Moore's masterclass, but so much of that is spent as his just loving homage to world building. He gushes about world building, about the great authors that world build, the people that truly make you feel like you are spending time in a real fictional world. And he does such a good job of figuring out all the little details that make a world feel legit instead of just like a painted on pastiche or a background set for our plot. Mm-hmm.
It's thinking about Top 10. It's an interesting book to talk about, especially, I feel like, in today's climate, because this book came out late 90s, early 2000s. And then you read it going into 2024. And, you know, with the current state of how we talk about policing and stories that surround policing, this is a book that doesn't hold a lot of punches and steers into a lot of those cliches and the really bad aspects of policing. And I had a question for you, Dallas. Did you feel like this book handles the topic in a way that feels, because to me, it kind of felt like a little tongue-in-cheek where it's like, hey, we're going to throw in elements of like racism, sexism, brutality, but it uses the pastiche, it uses the visage of the superhero world to kind of like, almost like numb it and make it seem ridiculous. Do you feel like that felt appropriate, or do you feel like it kind of underscored like the reality of police procedurals? Do you think that was intentional on Alan Moore's part?
I actually have an objective answer for this. Alan Moore talks about exactly this in his Maestro course. He talks about how this is a world-building exercise for him. He says, in a world where aliens and robots and mutants and everything else exists right along everyone else, he's like, human-on-human bigotry didn't make a lot of sense to him. He's like, sadly enough, Alan Moore feels that like bigotry is part of being human, that humans will find a reason to hate something parallel to themselves. And so for him, the robots became the receptacle for that hate. He thought that they felt the most alien and strange, and so therefore like the lightning rods for hatred. And so whether or not I agree with Alan Moore, I do think it's interesting that this is not meant to be a painted over critique of our world. It is a world building exercise built on Alan Moore's observations of our world. Right. Because and then he does in a very like old man way, think it's very clever to be like, but what if the one that they're all racist against is the very best cop? And he says that in his Maestro course, like, gotcha, conservatives. And I'm like, Alan, that's not that fresh of an idea.
I fixed racism.
But I'm happy for you. What if there was a good one then, huh? Like, okay, Alan, I need you to go for a walk and maybe leave England for 5 seconds. But
I do love Joe, though.
Joe's great. Alan's like, I very purposely made Joe the best character, the character you would love the most, to kind of like show you that this bigotry is ridiculous. And I'm like, Alan, I just think bigotry is ridiculous.
You don't have to convince me. Just,
you know,
just go with it.
Most of us are on that page.
Oh, okay. I'm glad I asked that question then. That was good to know.
Yeah. I do think it's fascinating revisiting this Gotham Central and Powers, which all came out around the exact same time and were all police procedural superhero stories, and to see how these different creators handled that idea of the police procedural, right? Like Ed Brubaker and Greg Rucka have a very grounded, visceral human story set in this police procedural. It's essentially a crime story set in Gotham, right? Calling Gotham Central a superhero story seems a little funny. I have not read Powers. I think you have, right?
I've read the first volume of Powers, and I would love to read it on the show at some point. It's a very wonderful book.
I would also love to read Powers on here. It's not published yet, but I had the opportunity to talk to Michael Avon Oeming, and I am itching to read more of his work after meeting him. But so I can't quite speak to how that feels like a Brian Michael Bendis comic. Do you feel like it feels uniquely Bendis and Oeming in the same way that Gotham Central feels pretty uniquely Brubaker, Rucka, and Greg and Michael Lark?
I'm trying to think back, because it's been a few years, but I remember reading Powers and it felt very unique for Bendis. Like, it didn't feel like a lot of Bendis's other work, but I think at the time I just finished his entire New Avengers runs at Marvel. So I think when I went to Bendis, that was the first thing my mind went to. It feels, if you read something like Scarlet, it feels more in line with that, but it has that Bendis sense of humor. It feels more like, a Batman universe, but like with that noir twist than it does anything like New Avengers or Avengers or even Ultimate Spider-Man.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think Top 10 is Police Procedural by Alan Moore. in a way that like no one else could even come close to pastiching. Just the thought that goes into the world, the interpersonal dramas, the meta context, like it feels like a meditation on so many things, but first and foremost on the fictional world in which it is set, which I think is one of the most undervalued aspects of what Alan Moore does. I think we often, because Watchmen is so, and V for Vendetta are so tied to specific times in our world, we often take for granted the fact that things like Swamp Thing and Tom Strong and Promethea and Top 10 or whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow are so firmly entrenched in taking their world seriously. Alan Moore creates a world and lives in it and thinks about it and makes sure that we look at all the aspects of this fictional world instead of just making that world a pastiche of our own.
This is going to be a very nerdy question, completely unbecoming of the beautiful words you just said. Is Top 10 in the same universe as Tom Strong?
Yes, it is. They all show up at the end of Promethea together.
Did they?
Yeah, if you circle back, or if you read issue 36 of Tom Strong, you will see the top 10 characters in the background of Promethea ending the world. America's Best Comics is all one universe.
God. That's a... Those are three very, very different tonal comics. That's a lot of distance right there, but that's really fun.
So Promethea was meant to be the apocalypse of America's Best Comics, something that Alan Moore signed on for when he created America's Best Comics. Is he actually wanted a comics universe that had a crisis event that actually ended the comics forever. And so that was like something that was pitched going into America's Best Comics, is this is a ticking clock. Time runs out. Like this, there will be a hard end to this. And his sort of tongue-in-cheek thing he did then was the Promethea end of the world, birth into a spiritual existence, right? That's how he flipped that on its head. But then he did stop publishing the comics after that. Other than League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which is also an America's Best Comics comic, but it is set like 150 years before all the other ones. And so it gets to keep
doing something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. So what you're saying is we read them all in the wrong order. We should have gone back. We should have gone like Tom Strong, Top 10, and then Promethea.
I actually really liked reading Promethea before Tom Strong, because then Tom Strong issue 36 made a lot of sense.
That's very true.
But yeah,
we probably could have read. This did not have the tie-in.
Yeah.
Was there any reason that you know that they split it up the way they did? Why they did the first 12 issues and then spun into several different minis and then a season 2?
I have no idea. I mean, you can see in issue 12 that Alan Moore begins the branching for each of those two series, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's the, I'm going to go off with Smacks. And then, hey, husband, remember when we were superheroes in the 1940s? And then the next two series are, we're going to Smax's house, and hey, honey, remember when we were superheroes in the 1940s? And then I think, similar to Tom Strong, Alan Moore decides to take a step back in his retirement in 2003, but these contracts then get run out by the artists and guest writers. And I think that's what season 2 and Beyond the Furthest Precinct are. Beyond the Furthest Precinct is interesting, though, because Gene Ha isn't attached, nor is Alan Moore. It is two unrelated people. And then season 2 is Gene Ha on art, and he has a story credit as well. But he then has different writers with him. So, I don't know.
Interesting. I'm really interested about both 49ers and Smacks, but especially Smacks, because I know that Smacks goes straight from police procedural into fantasy, and that feels like a really big departure. I'm not sure how that series is going to read once I actually keep going. I love the procedural. I want to keep going with the procedural. I'm not sure how I'm going to feel to take a break and go to visit Alan Moore's Bone or whatever.
It's interesting as well, and it feels appropriate for the kind of story it is, but Xander Cannon's pencils feel drastically different from Gene Haw's. Gene Haw is someone who I did not have on my radar at all, but he is up there with Frank Quitely for me in his ability to just build interesting, like you said, superhero world, superhero costumes. Mm-hmm. He understands the iconography and understands how to pastiche while still feeling interesting. I mean, look no further than our Doberman Pinscher sergeant in his robot body than to see Gene Haw's brilliance in this series.
I love that most of the time he was either wearing a Hawaiian shirt or a shirt that just says dog.
That's my guy right there.
That's my guy.
That's my G. I love his little glasses.
He's in his little hat.
He's a G. He's a G. And his chucks. He's a G.
There's no other. Chucks?
Yeah, he's in chucks.
Damn. Okay, I didn't even notice that. Yeah, no, you're right. He's a real one.
Yeah, he's that guy. Also, remember when he had the whole line about being colorblind and not being attracted to Lee because...
Jesus Christ. And then there's the bathroom moment where he's like, so I told her I wasn't attracted to people.
Dirty dog. Literally dirty dog. At first, I was like, come on. And then I was like, nah, that feels very real. Nah, that's real.
I just realized, I was about to comment where it's like, there's so many background plots in this book that go on at the same time, and most of them have resolutions. I think there's only one that doesn't, and it's the goose ghost or whatever. The ghostly goose.
That just ends up on the back of that chair?
Yeah, that's how that ends. It's like, that thing better come in season two, because I need to understand what in the plastic man hell is happening right now.
I also loved the rumor, the like ghost of the precinct.
Yeah, that we see them once and then poof.
Never again.
I'm glad there's a season two, because it felt so weird to have Troy Box be like our POV character through this entire thing and then have her in the hospital for the last two or three issues.
It did, but it allowed the breathing room for the other characters to exist. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel bad I don't remember her name, but Tank Woman, her arc.
Hermageddon.
That
Irmageddon. Yeah.
Irmageddon. And her little arc with Joe was awesome. Seeing their little story, seeing Smacks soften over the course of this. Like, I genuinely feel like every character got a great arc. And so to have Toy Box pulled back a little bit allowed us to spend time with Peregrine, spend time with Irma, spend time with Yosemite Sam and his mom.
Peregrine, she's walking that tightrope. I'm watching her ass.
She's a boring and Christian.
She gotta watch herself. I love that she what's her face? The ghost woman. She's like, she says Jesus, and then she's like, hey, listen, remember our agreement? You don't say Jesus, I don't say slurs. Yeah, keep that in mind. I love that they have that little understanding where it's like, This is a toxic ass relationship if I've ever seen one, but I'm loving it. This is so messy.
That's how this whole book feels. Like, this book has warts. Like, Godzilla shows up with a beer gut in a t-shirt that says no fat chicks while he's chugging brewskis out of the back of semis.
Yes.
And like, what a visceral image. There are so many moments in this where you're just like, man, people suck, but in an endlessly compelling way. Like, what do you mean no fat chicks? Shut up, look at yourself, beer gut Godzilla. Get a grip.
Check yourself.
But it feels real, you know. It feels legit. Or the born again Christian being like, don't take the Lord's name in vain or I'll start saying slurs. Like, geez, that's crazy. But also that feels kind of real.
Yeah.
It feels like the kind of mutually assured destruction that coworkers have.
We all got that one coworker that's just one slip up away from saying slurs.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. In Anne's office, it's her, believe it or not. You wouldn't guess it, but it's her.
I got post-its up saying, don't say it.
keep it in, Anne. And it's like a very Ohio specific one that doesn't make sense to anyone else. You call someone a Buckeye.
You fucking corn checker. I don't
look at those Huskers over there.
Jeez. Kiss your mother with that mouth.
I'm sorry. I got the Ohio specific slurs. Leave in the comments what you think an Ohio specific slur should be.
Don't leave in the comments what an Ohio slur is, or I will teach you firsthand.
You're gonna catch these men. I'm gonna send you to the skyline with this right hook.
Ram it right up your cornhole. Okay. Yeah. That's about it. All my thoughts on top 10. Boom. Killed it. Crushed it. We speed ran this episode.
I mean, a little bit. There is just a lot to love about this comic, but it's hard to put into words in the way that we can talk for hours about Promethea. We can talk for a long time about Tom Strong. I feel like I like top 10 the best.
Yeah.
And yet it feels like we're belaboring the point to explain all the background gags, to explain the jokes and the little intimate moments. I think you should experience them.
Mm-hmm. It's, yeah, I think that's about that. It's hard to get into this book without just telling you everything that makes it magical. It needs to be experienced.
And can you give us a little bit of your thoughts on Gene Haw's writing before we slide into the luckily extensive listener questions this week?
You mean Gene Haw's art?
Yeah, what did I say?
Writing.
Damn. Thanks.
Damn, Daniel. Gene Haw's art is wonderful. It's like we've talked a bit about the background gags and just all the world building that he's done. But beyond that,
what about how Smax is naked? What about when he has his holster over his butt cheek?
Hey, how about the fact we have a comic in the early 2000s where one of the characters is literally a naked woman the entire time, and she's never posed in, like, an obviously sexual way for the point of being sexual? Have I told you what I've been thinking about that so much, where it's just, like, in Marvel and DC for so long, they're like, hey, look, here's this woman, here's her ass and her tits in the same shot, just so you know that it's a woman. I've been thinking, like, isn't that like, how do you look at a picture like that, like as a man, as the like target demographic, and not feel a little insulted? Like, do they think we're not going to get it? Do they think they have to shout it at us that we're supposed to be aroused right here? It feels like doing so much work for so little worthwhile outcome. This book has subtlety. They know you don't need to do shit like that to have a compelling story, to have compelling characters, to have beautiful, beautiful framing and compositing. It's, I don't know. It's not a typical early 2000s comic in the way that I can read it. Even though there's naked characters in it, I can read this book in public and feel like no one's going to give me a weird look.
That's very true. And I love when Detective Lee's creators show up.
Jesus.
And they're trying to make it gross. And all of Lee's coworkers are just like, you guys just don't get it at all. And you feel that as well as the reader, where you're like, that's
it's not the
that's
point
not
here.
Even what I was noticing. Like,
yeah.
She was just interesting and compelling and funny and competent. And I think I texted you, or I said this on a call. When she died, my knee-jerk reaction was to be like, ugh, of course they kill off the... Wait a second. There are a lot of female characters in this. They didn't just defeat the strong female character. They defeated one of the characters. Wow. I got mad before I needed to.
Look Isn't that crazy? It's like, there's ways that a trope is not a trope.
Yeah. Turns out if you give all of your female characters just as much space to be powerful and interesting as your male characters, it's not fridging or problematic to let one of them die. Then it's just a character dying and not a burying the gaze or fridging a woman.
Yeah. Shit, I don't think we buried any gays in this book. Papa.
The only gay got to go home. kiss his husband.
Hey, we also have Ghost Lass, whose name I cannot remember, who struck out in issue one. God bless her heart. She tried.
You gotta shoot your shot.
She shot her shot. And Toy Box, hey, you're missing out. That's a keeper.
I love the cowboy with the 12 shooters.
I love him so much. And his stupid sparky partner.
His stupid sparky partner that's a racist.
And... he was so fun until he was a racist. And it's like, damn, did you like stick your finger in a toaster or something? That's how you got your powers? Is that why you're so like this?
Just insufferable.
Fucking insufferable. I think a robot killed his mom.
Maybe.
That's my fan theory.
I also love that the first five issues, and I'm not going to spoil it for the listeners, the first five issues are just a Jack the Ripper homage.
Mm-hmm.
And made me think of From Hell. And I was like, oh yeah, From Hell. I love you, my beloved.
Alan Moore is just like, I close my eyes and someone's killing women.
I mean,
this is wild.
Alan Moore is like, every day I think about Jack the Ripper. And then I do a bunch of hashish and climb into my tower.
Talk about Gene Haw's take on Martian Manhunter as this alien monster that forms the most terrifying otherworldly cocoon you've ever seen in your entire life. That is a terrifying villain.
It was awesome.
Oh my god. The fact that its little eyes were like down here. It was like evil space Caterpie.
So true. Or,
no, Metapod. Wrong Pokemon. Metapause.
Evil menopause.
Take my Pokemon card away. I'm not allowed to. Not allowed to do that anymore. Oops.
But sorry, bestie. The murder mystery of Balder was delightful the whole time. I was there like, this is he comes back to life. I know this myth because of Neil Gaiman, and it was a great end to that issue. This series did what Tom Strong did so well, where there was like. Extended arcs, there were one-offs, there were little mini stories. Like, you truly felt like you got everything the comic book form had to offer over the course of these 12 issues.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. And it just never loses that bit. It never loses that creative imaginative edge.
I think I'm sorry, I keep talking. You go.
No, I completely lost what I was gonna say. I was gonna make some comment. I remember what it, the fact that they have a Justice League prestige that is running a pedophile ring.
Yep.
Yep.
Good comic.
Alan Moore is not subtle.
No. Good comic.
Good comic. 10 out of 10.
Top 10 comics. Top 10. I forgot what I was going to say now, but that's okay. I liked what you said. I just think it's neat.
Thank you, Marge Simpson.
This comic, the America's Best Comics, feel like the zenith of Alan Moore's understanding of comic book pacing. They are always serial with a need to go forward for a few through lines, but always meaty enough to be a single issue with like one mystery being solved or one major character moment that we're focusing on. Like there's always a reason to spend time in the issue. And then there's also always a little reason to go on to the next issue. Like it feels like it understands what Bendis is mastering over in Ultimate Spider-Man, just like propelling people through at lightning speed through these issues where they have to read 60 issues of Ultimate Spider-Man in one run, but it hasn't lost what made Alan Moore fall in love with comics in the Silver Age with the one and done, every comic is someone's first comic, Stan Lee mantra. And his top 10, Tom Strong, Promethea, they all do this so well in a way that I don't think Alan Moore's other comics do.
Could you imagine what comics would be like today if Marvel and DC decided to take lessons from Top 10 and Tom Strong instead of Watchmen and V for Vendetta?
See, what's interesting is I don't think these comics exist if Watchmen and V for Vendetta and The Dark Knight Returns don't drastically change comics. Like, there is no
need. They are the course correction.
Yeah, they are Alan Moore trying at the end of his career to, like, put us back where we could have gone without, but it's a real like time traveler's conundrum where like these don't happen without Watchmen, right? Like Alan Moore doesn't become the writer that writes these without the heartbreak of seeing comics create Spawn.
No, that would if I wrote something that made Spawn, I would rethink my entire life. I'd be what is happening?
I wrote something so good that it killed the X-Men and birthed Spawn. I'm a monster.
Alan Moonster.
Alan Moonster. They're gonna kick him out of Northampton. That's the worst thing you could do to an Alan Moore is kick him out of Northampton.
It's so funny that every time I picture where Alan Moore lives, I picture like Yoda's hut on Dagobah.
I picture
it's just living in Northampton.
I picture like a Monty Python style tower with someone at the top like, "Hey, blimey! What you doing down there?" Like in the middle of just this bog, there's a single rundown stone tower that Alan Moore lives in. If he lives in a regular house, I'm going to be really disappointed.
I'm going to Google Alan Moore's house.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll
come. I'm going to dox Alan Moore right here on the podcast right now. Everyone listening, you good?
Oh, also, dear listener, I found this out, and so you get to find this out. Alan Moore is releasing the first of a series of 5 fantasy novels this year. And it sounds super Neil Gaiman-y and interesting. It's about like magic in London and finding out that there's like a magical underground to London that has, it's just very Neil Gaiman-y, very like there's magic in our world if only you know how to slip through the right cracks.
People in London are obsessed with other Londons. Like you have Neil Gaiman's Neverwhere, you have this new Alan Moore stuff, you have V.E. Schwab's Shades of Magic book where there's like different colored Londons. There's Black London, White London, Red London, like the pieces on a checker on a chessboard. What why are we so obsessed with London?
I don't know, but it's insufferable.
I don't know, but it's insufferable, damn it.
Dadgummit, we didn't kick you out of our country for nothing. It's because everyone kicked them out of their country, and so now they actually have to spend time in their own, and they're like, this sucks. What if there was here? A fantasy? What if there was a fantasy interesting version of our country?
What if there was just more London that we could colonize and imperialize? What if we did that? Like, now you're on to something. Now you're fucking cooking.
The most creative thing they can come up with is another version of what they've already got. Anyway, sorry, British listeners.
Sorry, British listeners. You have to be culturally sensitive, Dallas.
Sorry, British. Thank you for Alan Moore and Love Island, innit? Your two greatest exports, Alan Moore and Love Island.
Doctor Who.
Your three greatest exports in this order, Alan Moore, Love Island, Doctor Who.
There we go. Represent.
And
yeah.
Let's give the people a Patreon break.
Yeah, that's what they want.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Patreon of the Comics Collective, the weekly podcast where we read and discuss a collection of comic books or a graphic novel. I'm one of your hosts, Alexis.
I'm Dels.
And I'm Anne.
And we are here to talk with you today about our all new Patreon starting in January 2024.
Yeah, it's going to be really, really cool. And listen, honestly, I'm going to level with all of you out there. I really need a reason to just hang in there with these two a little bit longer. So if you could please find it in your hearts to give us just a little bit extra every month, I would really, really appreciate it so, so much. I can't speak for them, but I personally would really, really appreciate it.
Honestly, at this point, we either need a large sum of money or a large secret to keep us together. And I'm not ready for that kind of responsibility with a secret.
Also, please, please, everyone, find it in the goodness of your heart to finally aid in these two teaching me how to play Dungeons & Dragons. They've been leading me on for a long-ass time. And, hey, we've got lots of fun perks that we're going to roll out. I mean, this year, our goal, we want to keep things nice and clean. We want to keep our episodes to a predictable amount of time so everyone knows what they're expecting from an episode of the Comics Collective. But we don't want to feel like we have to cut out all of our shenanigans. So we found a place where we're going to stick it all. Please join us on our Patreon for all the shenanigans, all the fun. Please join us.
Leave us where we stick it all. The Patreon.
God damn it, Dallas.
But first, see, you missed this. You missed this silly, goofy time. The tiers for the Patreon are, first and foremost, at the $2 tier, early access to an ad-free version of the show. As soon as it's done editing, it's dropping on the Patreon. You don't have to wait till Wednesday mornings anymore. For $5 a month, you get early access of that ad-free show, and you also get a weekly extended after-the-credits chit-chat with Anne, Lexi, and Dallas, a closer to two-hour version of the show where we laugh, we joke, and we give you everything that of the classic comic books collective prior to Dallas's new tightened schedule regime. At the $8 a month tier, you will get a one-time specialized shout-out on the show and a live comic book recommendation in the show after you sign up. And for the exceptionally adventurous and affluent patrons of the Comics Collective, we have the option for a $50 a month tier where you will be added to a list of potential candidates for a Dungeons and Dragons one-shot adventure with the Comics Collective. After 1 month at the $50 tier, your name will be added to the list. Once the list has hit four individuals, we will run that 2 to 3 hour one-shot where I will DM, Lexi and Anne will play major characters, and you and your friends, or perhaps you and some strangers, will get to hang out with us on a Discord call for an afternoon. So if any of those sound interesting to you, please go to patreon.com/thecomicscollective and sign up now. Wow. Thank you so much for listening to that Patreon ad. You know, if you sign up at just the ad-free level, you never have to hear it again.
And if you sign up right now, Dallas will do a backflip on camera for all of you.
Holy shit, I just did it.
Oh and my God.
You can only see it at the $150 Dallas did a backflip tier. Thank you to viewers like you. And will you read our Glenn question, please?
Yes. I still have Glenn's Halo Jones question. Is that the one I'm reading?
It's okay, because it has nothing to do with Halo Jones.
Oh, perfect. Thank you, Glenn. Well, Glenn called us Hello Halos. Who would win in a wizard fight between Morrison and Moore? Morrison is Moore's rogue wannabe pupil, so you can't beat the teacher.
Yeah. Listen, as a certified Grant Morrison fan, I gotta say Grant has been chasing Moore's tail for a long time, and it doesn't feel like Moore thinks about Grant Morrison very often.
Yeah. Let me put this in a way that all of you out there will understand, especially you, Dallas. Moore is like Darth Sidious. He is Sheev Palpatine, and you got Grant Morrison out there as Darth Maul, and they're just really, really angry that Sheev is over here playing with his new apprentice, Count Dooku Gaiman, and so
that's actually perfect because it's like this nobleman that we took in.
Yeah. So Grant Morrison's over there, and they've recruited their mysterious brother Gerard Way to try to combat
Mark Millar.
Jesus Christ,
their evil brother Mark Millar that we're going to have to kill after a few episodes.
No, no. Listen, Savage Opress definitely sounds like a Mark Millar pen name.
So true.
The point is that Moore could take them both with one hand tied behind his back.
It ain't close. One of the greatest Star Wars fights of all time is Maul and Palpatine in Clone Wars.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I got the Darth Maul cut of Clone Wars from my brother-in-law. He sent me the watch list to All Killer No Filler Clone Wars, and hubba hubba, good show when you watch it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Star Wars: The Clone Wars Kai. That means nothing to Anne because she's not a Dragon Ball fan.
Yeah.
There's a Dragon Ball Tommy Z Kami Kai.
Yeah.
Dragon Ball Z Kai is the version where they get rid of all of the filler. So you just get to watch the story with none of the... I think I just watched that episode and nothing happened.
Well, that sounds fun, actually.
It is. It's quite...
I need a One Piece version. Kai.
I need a lot of things, Kai. I need my life, Kai.
Yeah, that's our answer, Glenn, if that's an answer. Also, look, it's been a long month of more books I haven't read. Oh, that was just Glenn informing us as to why he could not write a serious question. He also wrote, is it just me or does Halo Jones look like Anne? You're a flatterer, but that's it. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Listen, I feel like a lot of people haven't read the America's Best Comics line, myself included, before this month. Mm-hmm. And you are doing yourself a disservice. I want to track down the... Oh, what is it called? Tomorrow Stories is the only one I haven't read now. And it is super out of print. It is where that little boy at the end of Tom Strong, who was building the Doomsday device, that he had to flip the switch to un-Doomsday. Remember that? Yeah. He is from Tomorrow Stories. They're about like a superhero team of other America's Best comics. And it is super out of print. It is hard to find. If anyone's got a lead on that, let me know. Because I want to read it.
Here. I'm going to read Julian's and you can read Gianni's.
Gee, thanks.
No, I just, you got that one. I'm really excited you all are covering one of my favorite books. My question is, do you feel like the fact that the officers are superhuman or mystical affects any of the metaphors or allegories? Given some of the heavy subject material, are there things that these officers can get away with as cops that a regular hero like Superman couldn't and vice versa? Given the complicated relationship between the public and police and the real world, I'm curious as to what you think. Thank you, Julian. Well, first, Superman can't get away with slurs, so... They got him beat in that category.
Garth Ennis begs to differ.
nervous laugh.
I mean, Superman's never going to talk evil pedophile Superman into...
Killing himself.
So, you can't have that.
Homelander, I think you should jump.
Yeah. I really liked Top 10. And I talked about this with Kelly Thompson once, the like two wolves inside of you. One understands that all police procedurals are propaganda and therefore bad. And then the other wolf that loves a police procedural.
Yeah.
And that was me with Top 10 this week being like, man, I know all cops are bastards. And every one of these characters is a bastard. Compels me, though.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, and the fact that these are superpowered characters that are never written as superheroes, but only written as cops, means that they can get away with things like police brutality and casual racism and tough relations with the public. I don't think there's superpowered characters in fancy costumes, but I never read them for a moment as superheroes.
And I think that's really interesting. And it's an element that we don't see a lot in Western comics. If someone has powers, they are forced to either become a hero or a villain. And Top 10 is a comic that just explores what being a human with those powers is like.
Yeah.
It actually reminds me a little bit of Kurt Busiek's Superman Secret Identity, where it's much more of an exploration of what that would actually feel like in our real world to have those kind of powers. That's one of the best Superman stories ever. I can't believe I sold my copy of that book. That is one of the dumbest decisions I've ever made.
You fool.
I was a buffoon. I didn't realize it was super out of print when I sold it. Because I had just gotten it for regular off the shelf. I didn't know. Buffoonery. Stuart Immonen drawn Superman. You fool. You buffoon.
Unreal.
Live and learn.
Absolutely unreal.
Live and learn. And are there any, like, do you feel like Top 10 would work as not a police procedural? Like, if we had the same city, the same concept of superheroes only, or superpowered individuals only town, is there a different genre or plot device you think could have explored this better than the police procedural?
I think there's infinite plot devices you can use. I'm currently, one of the books I'm reading through right now for a book club I'm in is Legends and Lattes, which is just this D&D book about a fantasy world where the main plot is just an orc retires from fighting to set up a coffee shop. And the whole premise of the book is around building, okay, what does that look like in this world? What does a coffee machine look like? How do you start this business? What's the difference between that and the real world? And it's just so much familiar scenery through a different lens. And when you have a lens as wonderfully creative and vivid as the top 10 lens, as that universe, as Neopolis, then you can have, there's infinite potential for stories. Just pick any situation. What does an office job look like? What does, we could follow fucking Blindfold Bob as he takes people around the city all day.
So good.
Fucking Blindfold Bob. He's a menace.
He's my menace.
You could do a superhero coffee shop. Steal the idea I just said. Fuck. Superhero construction. What does that look like? What does a superhero architect have to think about? Superhero cooking. I don't know. What does Hell's Kitchen look like when Gordon Ramsay is actually the devil? I don't know. Just, there's so much potential. Just pick a random thing that you love and say this, but top 10 it.
I also think with Alan Moore's comic Providence that I might make Anne and Lexi read next March is Alan Moore understanding that the police procedural is propaganda, decides that then the solution is to focus on reporters, mm-hmm. because the free press is always morally upright. We like the free press. We like people that report on corruption and on people in power. And so you get a lot of the exact same, like diving into the underbelly of a city without enforcing fascistic ideas. Yeah. And so Providence follows a reporter in the 1920s. And that, again, learned from Alan Moore's Maestro course, that was very intentional. That was, I don't want to do a story about a cop, therefore I do a story about a reporter. And that feels like a pretty easy, you get to tell the exact same kind of story without having to carry around the weight of needing to say something about police in America.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why you'd be concerned. It seems like such a light subject.
Especially, the Brits love to do it. The Brits love to be like, let's talk about American police. Like, okay, well.
Well, to them, it's like, man, you still got the Wild West going on everywhere over there. That's crazy. Let's talk about it.
There is this genre of TikTok, and that's so funny. It's built off of this, I guess they're called roadsters. They're like guys that mug you in London.
And what?
There was this video that talked about how Americans are really hurting roadsters' feelings because they're not intimidated by them. Because in America, we have like real threats. And then, so when you're over in London, and this guy's like, run me them trainers, love. You're like, first off, what does that even mean? Like, go away. Like, come on, I've got this. And then they pull like a 3-inch knife because it's England and that's the biggest weapon they can get. And it's like,
yeah,
buzz off, bucko. Like, skedaddle. And it's just like a bunch of British people coming to terms with the fact that Americans aren't intimidated by them. Mm-hmm. And it has since birthed like really funny reenactments of those scenes where people put on really crazy filters to look extra British and then get their feelings hurt that people don't want to mug them or that people won't let them mug them. And I think that's really beautiful. Every time we make fun of the British online, it's really beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Every time we do, an angel gets their wings.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Yeah.
All right. Gianni, we love you. So I'm going to read this long email. There was an email so long it didn't make it into the show this week. So I am sorry to whoever sent that. I read it. It was super well thought out. Not reading all that shit.
Just call it shit.
High quality, too high long quality. For the air. High quality, too long for the air. Hello again, Dallas, Ann, and Lexi. Gianni, if you really listened, you would know Alexis is dead. We told you all last week.
Yeah.
Alexis is
vivid detail.
Alexis is our dearly departed. So hello again, Dallas, Anne, and the late Lexi Taylor. This has been such a fun run of episodes discussing one of my favorite creators ever, Alan Moore, especially Tom Strong, which I have been championing for years. Halo Jones is actually a series I've never heard of. I'm eager to start reading it and can't wait to hear what you have to say about it. Gianni, you're going to have to wait till next year. My question this week is, if Alan Moore were to ever come back to comics, which is highly unlikely, unfortunately, what type of stories would you want to see from him, and who would you want to see him collaborate with? Someone we haven't seen him work with yet. Also, just as a PS, I wanted to share my appreciation for you guys. I've had a very rough few months mentally and don't have many friends at the moment, especially those who talk comics. The only friends I have that's into comics I rarely get to see because of college. This podcast every week always brightens my day up and helps fill in that void. You guys are so genuine and always put a smile on my face. I love this show so much, and you guys have inspired me to try out my own podcast with said friend mentioned earlier, just for fun, which has helped grow our friendship even more, and that wouldn't have happened without me discovering this lovely podcast. So I thank you. Sorry for rambling on for so long. LOL. Have a great rest of your day and sending good vibes, Gianni.
Oh, Gianni, you're making me tear up.
Yeah,
you're
listen, the best. We'll read long emails if they tell us we're pretty. Like, that's that's simple math. Gianni, thank you for your appreciation, and thank you for being such a fun contributor to the culture of the show. It's always fun when we get one of your emails. You are definitely someone that we are aware of in a positive way. And that is a lot of fun.
Yeah. And kudos on you and deciding to start a podcast. We can always, always use more voices, especially positive voices in this community. So it's always appreciated.
You've got to balance us out. We are very quickly going to sell out and start hate clicking comics. Yeah. So like, get in on this while you can, because next week, we're talking about how comics have gone woke and they're ruining our childhood.
So true.
Because after a month of Alan Moore hidden gems, I think we have 7 listens this week. I got to get back on. I got to hit that dopamine button. Yeah. We're going to talk about something that we hate and that everyone else can agree and want to dunk on.
Yep. You're going to meet the Auntie Anne who hates any woman.
I hate woman. You're gonna meet just Dallas. I it's who I am. I'm already toxic.
I'm already there.
I'm already there. I've just been tricking you all. It's a little bit, it's a real Clark Kent put on his glasses type disguise that's got you all convinced that
you're
one
pair of glasses away from just making a thumbnail with Brie Larson on it and being like, listen.
Yeah, these shit's glasses, wild. The thin line between secretly toxic circle metal frames to openly toxic black square frames is a very thin line.
That is, wait, no, that's peak Earth 3 Dallas design.
It's the evil Dallas. The Dallas that never met Addison and therefore fell down an alt-right credit pipeline. Alt-right, they are often alt-ripe. Just need to learn how to shower. Anyway, Anne, who do you want to see Alan Moore collaborate with? Here's a super left-hand one. This is super out of the blue. Scotty Young.
Oh.
I want to see Alan Moore and Scotty Young do something crazy.
That could be fun.
Right?
That could also be really fun.
I think Alan Moore could get Scotty Young back on interior pencils. And that would be incredible.
Oh. Listen, anytime Scotty Young's on interior pencils, it's
like, imagine Alan Moore's take on like Muppet Babies as drawn by Scotty Young.
I'm sold. I'm right there. Maybe it's because I'm thinking about, what's his name? Jorge Fiornes.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Where I'm like, if we want to see Alan Moore go down like a From Hell rabbit hole again and draw something pretty serious.
I know Alan never got to do anything with David Mazzucchelli, so Jorge Fornes is our modern-day David Mazzucchelli.
Mm-hmm. Just comes from the next generation.
I know there are people at home right now that are like, Jorge Jimenez, Pepe Larraz, Daniel Warren Johnson, and that just doesn't feel correct for an Alan Moore book. Like, you need to have a little bit of grit in the oyster to make the pearl with Alan Moore. Like, the art has to be a little rougher around the edges than those highly polished, incredible artists.
Thinking. Not sure if I have any others off the top of my head.
I would love to see Felipe Andrade from The Many Deaths of Lila Starr fame work with Alan Moore. I think they could do something really esoteric and interesting. Actually, I would love, and again, next March, I think I'm going to have to make us read Supreme, Alan Moore's Superman comic that he did with Rob Liefeld. I think it would be fun to see Alan Moore with like a quintessential superhero artist do just like a bright, shiny, Silver Age superhero comic. Because again, in Alan Moore's Maestro course, he said if he ever came back, he would be doing 1966 Batman or Silver Age Captain Marvel comics. He's like, there'd be talking animals. There would be morality tales that are one issue long. He's like, there'd be sidekicks and it would be bright, shiny, and like squeaky behind the ears kind of comics is what he would want to make. The kind of stuff he read as a kid.
A Doc Shaner or like a Leonardo Romero.
Doc Shaner would be incredible. Basically just like turn Tom King's toy box upside down and shake it. And that's who I think Alan Moore should work with.
Alan Moore and Elsa Sheratier.
Honestly, I would love to see Alan Moore collaborate with a woman.
Let's be realistic here.
Outside of Lost Girls, I don't think he's done it. And I would
it's so insane that the one time he did is Lost Girls. That's fucking wild. We will not be covering Lost Girls, by the way.
You want to hear something nuts?
Yeah.
My friend, his introduction to comics has been Lost Girls because one of his favorite indie Swedish house artists released a concept album called Lost Girls that he loved. And so he looked up where the name came from and it came from her love of this comic. And so he texts me and he says, have you ever heard of a comic called Lost Girls? And I go, yeah, I've heard of it. And he's like, should I read it? And I explained the premise and he's like, yeah, I think I'm going to read it. And apparently Lost Girls has become really huge in the New York gay scene, not just from him, but just like the New York gays are reading and loving Lost Girls because of this house artist. And he's like, what Alan Moore should I read next? I heard there's a really good Jack the Ripper one. And so I'm just obsessed with this idea of someone finding out who Alan Moore is through Lost Girls, having never heard of Watchmen. It's incredible.
That's an incredible... I want to pick their brain. I want to talk to them.
He's fun. Robert, I know you're not listening, but I love you.
There's been like a Lost Girls resurgence, I feel like, because I was talking to someone at Comic-Con and she was asking me, like, she was in the Women of Marvel panel. She's like, yeah, where should I start reading comics? I'm saying for this panel because I want to hear where I should start, especially if I'm interested in women-led stories. And I gave her some lists and she's like, okay, have you heard of a comic called Lost Girls? Because that's where someone else said I should start. And I'm like, that's definitely a choice. Theoretically, it is possible for you to start there.
My friend was like, I thought it was a little weird. There was a whole chapter about incest, but like, we'll see if it like circles around by the end.
Did it circle around?
He wasn't done yet, so I'll have to text him. I don't know.
You gotta let me know.
I genuinely love this. I love people who aren't brain rotted comics fans always like referring to the issues as chapters, right? They're like, oh yeah, this chapter of the book. And I'm like, you have a healthy brain. I love you. I want to hold you on either side of the cheek and kiss you on the forehead. Never find out what a single issue is.
You are precious.
Go, be free.
I want to go back to that time where I'd read an omnibus from the library, back when the omnibuses were just like white covers that said Star Wars omnibus and then had just a picture of it. And I'd read it and I'd be like, the art's different, but my brain wouldn't compute that it's because it's a different person drawing it each time. I'm just like, huh, it looks really weird now and I don't know why. I want to go back to that point of innocence.
I want to forget comics exist. Anyway. All right, collective. Love the book, and I love y'all's discussion on it. Thanks, Zach. you used your powers to see to the future to know that you liked this episode. Just the idea of a city entirely populated by superheroes and villains can provide a whole slew of potential story ideas. So my question is, what do you think, or where would you think you would fit into a city like that? And I guess you'd have to come up with your hero slash villain identity too. All right, so Anne's a villain, and I am very clearly the protagonist.
I love that we never read Zach's questions in the voice that he clearly wants us to read them in.
Sorry, Zach. You're getting Utah or Ohio accent.
I just think it's so funny. It happens every week. Zach, you're so persistent, and I love you for that. It's like, one of these days, I'll get them to slip into, I think it's Cockney, one of these days.
And I guess you'd have to come up with a hero villain identity, too. All right, Zach.
So, just beyond just heroes and villains, what would your dream job be in a superpowered city?
All right, so first off, my name is Encyclopedia Jones, and I have an encyclopedic knowledge of things that don't matter, because that's my real-life superpower. I can remember anything as long as it is unimportant. And so with that superhero ability, I would like to become a paleontologist. Because boy, do I already have a superhuman knowledge of every animal that has ever existed on the planet, even though that doesn't matter.
I love that we both kind of went into a similar route. I would be Dr. Animal, and I would be a zoologist in the Neapolis Zoo. And my superpower would be talking to animals, and I would talk to all the superpowered animals. We'd have atom cats, we'd have nuclear mice, we'd have elastic boas, super sharks, we'd have everything. I would love to study a superpowered biological ecosystem.
You just know somewhere in top 10 there is the chimpanzee who writes the dictionary.
Yeah.
He's somewhere, and he's gonna know animal.
He's out there.
He is. He's just
Dr. Animal.
Dr. Animal. That's true. I never got my PhD. I'm master's degree. Magoo.
Womp womp.
Womp womp. All right, Anne, do you want to read Jared's email?
Absolutely, I can. Top 10 question. We'll be the judge of that. Thank you very much. Hey, Comics Collective folks. Jared Talks Comics here. I've got a question for you. Do you prefer top 10 Tom Strong or Promethea? Dallas, what has been your favorite book that we've read this month from Alan Moore?
Promethea, not even close. How about you, Anne?
It was top 10. I think top 10 is my favorite. Yeah.
Top 10 is incredible. It is the most underrated Alan Moore book.
Yeah.
I don't feel like anybody talks about top 10. And then I read it, and then I started praising it, and everyone came out of the woodworks to be like, isn't it wonderful? And I was like, why aren't we talking about it more all the
time?
Did
you see my... Of course, you spend 10 minutes on Twitter. I post about top 10. I'm like, hey, show of hands, who's read top 10? And I had hundreds of people in those comments. Hundreds.
It's a comment, like, that makes an impact.
Holy shit. Yeah.
I love it.
I had Javier Rodriguez in there being like, yeah, me. I loved it.
Tell Javier Rodriguez to come on here and let me tell him he's the best comic book artist working today.
I'll twist his arm.
Yeah, say, listen, let us praise you for an hour. And he'll be like, no!
Yeah, that was Alan Moore. I hope all of you learned something.
Listen, if you want to see us do it again next year, let us know.
If you want to put Lexi through that, please.
If you want to put Alexis's head in a vice again, let us know. Because she hated it. She quit. She quit the podcast. But I think Anne and I really had a good time.
I feel so bad because I feel like the last two she would have liked.
I know.
Promethea destroyed any hope of that happening.
I know. She would have loved top 10.
And I hope she'll love Halo Jones when she goes through Halo Jones.
Me too. Anne, should we roll credits?
Absolutely. If you like the show and want to hear more from us through the week, please go follow our Twitter accounts at The Comics Collective or TikTok account at The Comics Collective. Or you can find each of us at Dallas_comics and at Anne Comics and at Lexi Lou_comics.
If you enjoyed the show and want to show your support, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening and give us a 5-star review. If you write that review, we'll read it off on the show.
Yeah, and finally, email us your questions or comments at any time to thecomicscollective@gmail.com. Try to keep them relatively short, please. We're begging you. We want to read your comments as much as you want us to read them. So please, do us a favor. Keep those pretty brief. And also, see you all next week for our return to Hellboy. We'll be reading the Hellboy short story Omnibus Volume 2.
Bum, ba, ba, bum. I hope Alexis is alive again.
I do too. Evan will be back. Lex is going to get resurrected. It's going to be great. Or cloned.
Or brought back to some other plot contrivance.
Hell yeah. Bye.
Bye.